You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. Wisconsin's conservative majority on the state Supreme Court ruled that police are justified to search someone because they smell marijuana in their car. But if there isn't any marijuana recovered from the search, doesn't matter, according to the ruling. The defendant in the case was convicted of fentanyl and cocaine possession after a police search found the substances in bags concealed under his clothing. The dissenting liberal justices say the officers in the case lacked probable cause for a search because marijuana smell is indistinguishable from legal substances like hemp or CBD. We're taking a look at the case and the wider concept of probable cause. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you agree with the court's opinion? Have you been searched by police or your vehicle has, in part because of the smell of something incriminating? Do you have questions about how probable cause works when it comes to police searches? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. John Gross is a clinical associate professor of law at UW-Madison. He directs the university's Public Defender Project. John, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for inviting me.
I want to zoom in on this particular case that came to the state Supreme Court here before we look at wider issues. The short version, police say they saw the defendant driving erratically, threw something out the window, pulling him over, did a quick search, but then smelled marijuana, they say, in the car. That led them to make a closer search, which ultimately found the incriminating evidence. Can you take us through the arguments that we saw as this worked its way up from the initial trials up to the Supreme Court?
Sure. So what's at issue here is whether or not the officers had what's referred to as probable cause to actually make an arrest. If they did have probable cause to arrest the driver of the vehicle, then they could conduct what's called a search incident to that arrest and search his person for any weapons or contraband, because the theory being they were going to take him into custody because they had probable cause to arrest. Now, probable cause is defined as a reasonable ground to believe that the person is committing or has committed a crime. So it's a very flexible standard. It's not just a possibility or a suspicion, but it's not the standard at trial, proof beyond a reasonable doubt. Officers are expected to use their common sense. The sticking point here was the officers claimed to smell marijuana. And while possession of marijuana in Wisconsin is illegal still, and there is a case from about 25 years ago that says that when officers smell marijuana, that is in and of itself probable cause to make an arrest. Recently, marijuana had, at least in Wisconsin, other things like hemp and CBD oils and things that can be ingested via vape pens. Those things have been legalized and they smell exactly like marijuana. And so the question was, just because the officers smell something like marijuana, can they be sure it's the contraband that contains the chemical THC, or could it be hemp or CBD oil, which is actually legal?
Another concern was the defendant said he had rented the car from someone, pointed out that he personally didn't smell like marijuana. There was the possibility that someone else had previously smoked marijuana in the car that didn't necessarily point toward the defendant having used it himself. Did this come up at any part of this chain of court trials?
Yes. I mean, this is another factor that goes into whether or not the police would have probable cause to believe that they could arrest the person for a marijuana-related offense, because the smell of marijuana, especially if it is smoked, can linger. Somebody could have smoked marijuana in the car earlier in the day, which could have led officers to smell marijuana when they pulled him over. But does that automatically lead to the conclusion that this person who's driving the vehicle is in possession of marijuana or under the influence of marijuana? Those are other questions that sort of go against this idea that at that moment, just because they smelled marijuana emanating from the vehicle, that they had probable cause to arrest the driver either for possession or perhaps for driving under the influence.
Now, this is clearly not a slam dunk case because some courts on the way up agreed that no, police didn't have probable cause. There's a slim, a 4-3 majority on the state Supreme Court agreed, oh, yes, they did have probable cause. So how often do we end up in these sort of gray areas of probable cause in the courts?
Yeah, so probable cause is, as you just said, it is a gray area. It is a very factually specific determination that police officers are asked to make. And courts honestly have trouble, drawing clear lines in this area because you want to give law enforcement some flexibility here. You anticipate that they will take into account all of the factors that they are observing and use their common sense and try to come to a conclusion about whether or not they think a crime was probably committed. But there are so many different factual scenarios that can arise when police are investigating potential crimes. It's hard for a court to give them clear direction. This, however, is one of those instances where at least the majority is giving police officers pretty clear direction, which is if they smell marijuana, that in and of itself seems to be enough for them to make an arrest.
John, a layperson might look at this and work backwards. Okay, ultimately, the police found fentanyl and cocaine in this person's possession when they did a more intense search than the initial pat-down. So in hindsight, that legitimizes the search in the first place because they did find something. That doesn't really justify things in the way probable cause is defined, as I understand it. Do I have that right?
Yes, I mean, you're correct. I mean, you cannot work backwards, right? Police officers can't decide to overstep reasonable grounds to commit a search and then say, but we did find something, so that makes what we did okay. No, if police officers engage in aggressive searches or seizures of people when they don't have probable cause to make an arrest, then the law actually recognizes that any evidence that they recover because of that unlawful, unjustified search or arrest, that evidence can be suppressed in a court of law. That can be thrown out. And so just because they find something after the fact is not enough of a justification to say that they were acting reasonably when they decided to conduct the search. It has to be based on what they know at the time they decide to make an arrest or initiate a search, not from what they learn after the fact.
Talking to John Gross, clinical associate professor of law at UW-Madison. He directs the University Public Defender Project. We're looking at probable cause in Wisconsin, probable cause for police searches after a state Supreme Court ruling on the issue saying that, yeah, the smell of marijuana coming from a car is probable cause enough to search the car, the person who was in the car. You could join in with your thoughts, maybe your experiences, at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller. Bill is with us in Milwaukee. Bill, hi.
Hello, everybody. I do not smoke marijuana in my car, but I've been driving where the people ahead of me are. The smoke gets in my car. Now, what if some cop stops me, sticks his head in my window, and smells that? Are you supposed to grab me and search me?
Bill, thanks for the call. Now, in the case before the Supreme Court, John, the officers had described it, I think, as an overwhelming smell of marijuana or pervasive. Could, in Bill's instance, sort of a secondhand smoke, literally, justify a police search?
Well, I hope it wouldn't, but I think when you look at the language of this decision, it does send the message to officers that if they happen to smell marijuana, that's enough. Now, it could be, as the caller suggests, it could be secondhand smoke. It could be from somebody else smoking in the vehicle earlier in the day, or even before that, if the odor lingers. So that's the real concern here, right? The real concern is that just because officers might credibly say, I think I smell marijuana, does that really entitle them to conduct an arrest and a search of the person and a search of the vehicle? Is it really reasonable to jump to the conclusion that the mere odor suggests the presence of marijuana at that moment?
Thanks a lot for that call, Bill. Now, John, I suspect some people might be listening with an assumption that police are going to abuse the concept of probable cause and massage it to justify any search they want to do. And some people are listening, thinking that police are going to be well-intentioned and use it appropriately. Do we have any sense of how probable cause is used in practice on average by police departments?
So, I mean, I would say that most law enforcement officers are trying to make a good faith effort based on all the facts and circumstances to figure out whether or not they truly have probable cause to make an arrest or conduct a search. But I think there's also a legitimate concern about an officer being able to claim that they happen to smell marijuana. I mean, as a defense attorney for most of my career, it's almost impossible to challenge that in court. I can't go back in time and test the area around the vehicle to see whether or not it did smell like marijuana. By the time a defense attorney gets a case like this, that odor has completely dissipated. So it's really giving an officer a blank check. If the officer wants to just claim that they smelled marijuana, it's very difficult to challenge that in court. Now, of course, as in this case, when the officer says they smell marijuana, but they don't find any in the vehicle or on the person, well, that might undercut the officer's credibility. But ultimately, you're still asking a judge to, you're asking a judge to consider whether or not the officer is lying to them. And that is a heavy burden to me in a courtroom.
Talking to John Gross, Clinical Associate Professor of Law at UW-Madison. He directs the university's Public Defender Project. And we're looking at a ruling from Wisconsin's Supreme Court on probable cause in a case that involved a search after officers say they smelled marijuana in a car. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have about probable cause, how it works here in Wisconsin? Do you agree with this state Supreme Court decision? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our talk about probable cause and police searches with John Gross, director of UW-Madison's Public Defender Project. A ruling on that issue from the state Supreme Court came out earlier this week. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your questions about probable cause, maybe your experiences. 800-642-1234 is the number to call. Back to your calls now. Jim is with us in Watertown. Jim, hi.
Hello. Thanks for taking the call. I mean, there's a gray area here, but I think that the courts dropped the ball on this one. Here in Wisconsin, what is it, an ounce, up to an ounce, and it's a misdemeanor? Why are they searching this guy, like, and as in getting ready to arrest him? And, I mean, and this is all in, you know, if you're thinking that all the police are going to do the right thing. You know, for a smell, I think that it should be padded. Now, granted, if you're able to look at what happened after the fact, yeah, the guy had a dangerous substance that needs to be taken off the street. Absolutely. And so, you know, if you're able to look at that, yes, you know, he needed to get arrested. But
Jim, thanks a lot for the call. John, he points out that possession is a misdemeanor, but it is a misdemeanor that can result in jail time. So that potentially could lead to an arrest. Do I have that right?
No, oh, that's correct. I think we should be very clear that possession of marijuana in Wisconsin is still illegal in Wisconsin, even though some of our neighboring states have changed their laws, and Wisconsin does allow for certain hemp products and CBD products, which are a derivative, but don't contain the active chemical THC that is what makes marijuana illegal. So a person can be arrested for it. It is a misdemeanor, typically. So we are still talking about a crime.
Jim, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. Martha is with us now in Menominee. Martha, hi.
Hey, Rob. Say, I'm kind of with Jim on this one. The this claim, you know, I thought I smelled marijuana. Sounds a lot like, quote, I thought I saw a gun, you know, close quote. I think it's too general and too able to be used to abuse, for abuse. I think the cops can lie too easily with this. And the criminal justice system is already stacked against the defendant. And so I think that there should have to be something in addition to that, like not wearing your seatbelt or a gun that I thought I saw was visible or whatever in addition for this to be probable cause.
Martha, thanks for the call. John.
Yeah, well, I have to say that this issue has come up in numerous states who have either legalized marijuana to some degree or have also legalized hemp or CBD products that smell exactly like marijuana. And I think the Wisconsin court decision here is a bit of an outlier, frankly. Other courts who have considered this under a similar set of circumstances have said the fact that we have something that is legal to possess that smells like marijuana means that just the odor of marijuana is not enough to establish probable cause to arrest. And so I think this decision is a little out of step with what other state Supreme Courts have been finding when they've addressed this same issue.
Thanks for the call, Martha. John, though, a lot of these probable cause cases, they're going to involve something that involves something subjective on the part of the arresting officer, right? You might perceive somebody is behaving in a threatening way. Somebody else might look and say, I don't think they're being that threatening. We put some kind of subjective judgment onto police. I don't think there's any choice in that. Is that right?
That's true. I mean, you want officers to be able to respond to the threat of criminal activity in proactive ways. And you want them to take reasonable steps to address public safety and the various scenarios that they can come can encounter on a daily basis, from traffic stops to reports of domestic violence. It's hard to give them, a precise calculation as to when there is or is not probable cause. But I mean, that being said, I think a lot of times if an officer misperceives something and makes an arrest in sort of an abundance of caution, witnesses can be interviewed and there's a burden placed on proof beyond a reasonable doubt at trial. But when you talk about situations where there's contraband, right, that the item itself that the officer is attempting to locate is a crime, whether it's drugs or a gun, these are areas where we might want to really be cautious when evaluating whether or not an officer has probable cause, because the recovery of the item itself constitutes the crime.
Thanks for that call. Molly is with us now in Madison. Molly, hi. Are you there, Molly?
The police are here to protect us. Whether or not they smell something, shouldn't they just be allowed to protect us? Or off the street.
Molly, thanks for the call. Molly was breaking up there, but I think leaning toward erring on the side of, hey, let police make these judgments if they perceive this as a need to protect the public.
Yeah, and I know a lot of people feel that way, and people often view, evidence being suppressed or thrown out as a sort of legal technicality. But look, there's also important personal privacy, Fourth Amendment rights for people. People don't want to be pulled over and detained and have their car searched over nothing, right? On the suspicion that the officers might recover some type of drugs or an illegal weapon. So there has to be a balance here between wanting to protect personal privacy, wanting to protect people from police harassment, from racial profiling, and also. Legitimate law enforcement efforts to remove dangerous, harmful drugs or weapons from our streets.
Molly, thanks for the call. Sorry we lost that connection. Shane is with us now in Madison. Shane, hi.
Hey, how's it going? I just wanted to say on the topic that I find it very close to borderline to where it could be damaging to people's protected rights of random searches and seizures, that if you could just basically do it off of subjectively hearsay, I just find that rather inappropriate. I had a experience a few years back where I was pulled over in a vehicle I had just purchased. I didn't really live at the best side of town, and within the first like 16 hours of having this vehicle, I'm driving around and they're like, oh, well, we see this vehicle, it's a nice vehicle in a bad neighborhood, and we're kind of smelling marijuana. And I'm like, well, They ended up keeping me outside at negative degree temperatures in a t-shirt, finding nothing and wasting a bunch of my time.
Shane, thanks for the call. Just in our last minute or so, John, Shane raising the concern that if we allow too much leeway, we might be sacrificing some of our rights.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, as I mentioned before, we want to strike this balance. We do want officers to be able to have flexibility to make these difficult decisions they have to make in the moment to police harmful substances and dangerous weapons and get them off the street. But we also have to honor people's privacy rights, their Fourth Amendment rights, their rights to be free from an unreasonable search and seizure, which is in our Constitution, our Fourth Amendment. And the question really is whether or not the court struck the right balance in this particular case. And I'm a little skeptical that this was the right way to resolve the issue.
Shane, thanks for the call. And John, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
It's been my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
That's John Gross, Clinical Associate Professor of Law at UW-Madison. He directs the university's Public Defender Project. He joined us for a look at a new Wisconsin State Supreme Court ruling on probable cause for police searches. Coming up Monday here on Central Time, housing prices have been high for years in Wisconsin, and higher interest rates have raised the cost of mortgages. We'll get the latest on the housing market here in the state. And Wisconsin has lots of great river journeys, from short paddles to multi-day river camping, even a three-hour tour. Get some advice to get started or share your favorite expeditions in the state. You can respond on either of those topics, actually. You can email ideas@WPR.org. That's ideas@WPR.org. Love to hear your experiences on the housing market or on the river. Heck, both if you've done them both lately. Again, email ideas@WPR.org and then join those conversations and more Monday here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, it's Food Friday, and we're taking a trip to our local farmers markets to talk about farm fresh summer foods. First, we're taking a look at what to expect if you're flying in the coming months. 2023 has had the highest rate of flight delays since 2014. So far, things not looking up this summer. More than one in five flights are delayed, according to the U.S. Department of Transportation. The Biden administration last month proposed rules that would force airlines to compensate passengers for expenses resulting from cancellations and significant delays. In the meantime, it's up to the airlines themselves to decide how that compensation works. We're talking about summer air travel, and you can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you been on a plane this summer so far, this year so far? Did everything go smoothly, or did you encounter a delay, a cancellation? Have you ever had a big delay? Did you get anything from the airline from it? Were you part of the big Southwest fiasco at the end of last year? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Laura Albert is a professor of industrial and systems engineering at the UW-Madison College of Engineering. Her research focuses on modeling and solving real-world problems, including things like aviation security. Laura, welcome back to Central Time.
Hi, thanks for having me.
First, I want to get your thoughts on these rules proposed by the Biden administration, clarifying, insisting that airlines would have to compensate us if we get canceled or bumped back too long. What are your thoughts on those?
I'm generally a fan of making travel more fun and a little less expensive. One thing to keep in mind is this comes on the tail of a lot of delayed flights. You mentioned the Southwest fiasco, where there are a lot of canceled flights that honestly were preventable had Southwest taken proper steps to update their software so those delays wouldn't happen. Last year, we also saw a huge jump in airline fees, and that's due to inflation, but also all these labor shortages. The silver lining is that this year, air travel isn't necessarily supposed to be more expensive than it was last year when we had that jump up. But people are paying a lot for tickets, and then they have these delays, many of which can be prevented and aren't, and then it becomes very expensive for the consumer. And I think it's good to have some reasonable protections for consumers, and these are in line with the European Union's protection. So it's really not groundbreaking. It's really getting us probably to where we should have been.
Yeah, and it's things like not just, you know, we're going to fly you there eventually. It's also meals and accommodations and things like that, which airlines do sometimes provide, but they're not obliged to under federal law, as I understand it currently, Laura.
Exactly. And it can be very piecemeal. And, you know, I fly a lot. I've asked for some kind of reimbursement and occasionally I get a meal, which is better than nothing. But sometimes it's been on the consumer to ask and really depends on the airline and the type of delay. So this will be stronger protections for the consumer.
And this particular guideline would be for cancellations and significant delays caused by things within the airline's control, you know, not just bad weather and things like that. Looking at the delays we see over the last year, you mentioned Southwest. A lot of that was under the airline's control. How many of the delays we see now are, you know, preventable as opposed to, you know, acts of nature that we can't do anything about?
A lot of them are preventable. And it's kind of surprising that so many are preventable because typically it seems like weather delays my flights. But some of the ways that the preventable delays occur can be flight crew, maybe somebody called in sick and they didn't have a good backup, maintenance problems, various other crew problems, crew not getting to where they need to be, airline cleaning that's slow. There could be delays due to baggage loading. And then of course the big Southwest software delay that debacle led to a lot of cancellations actually. So some of this is due to the labor shortages and the labor issues that we've seen just across many different industries in the past few years. There's a lot of new employees in a lot of industries, and maybe they don't know all the protocols as well. There might be staffing shortages. Hopefully this will be smoothed out over time. And this new rule that's proposed provides a huge incentive for airlines to get it together and really provide a pleasant flying experience for passengers.
Talking to Laura Albert with UW-Madison College of Engineering, looking at air travel, delays, cancellations, how smoothly things go. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Love to hear your report on the state of air travel, if you've encountered it, if things went well, if things went poorly. Love to hear your story at 800-642-1234. And if you work in this industry for an airline, at an airport, in TSA, love to hear what you're seeing as well. Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Laura, let's walk into that airport. And of course, we're headed over to TSA security. What kind of lines, what kind of delays are we seeing there these days?
Unfortunately, we're seeing really long lines this summer. This is because travel is at the pre-pandemic level this summer, sometimes even exceeding pre-pandemic level. And a moment ago, I pointed out there have been labor shortages, and we're still seeing that at airports. The longer lines are longer at the hub airports, and particularly at the DC and New York area airports, where they just have more labor shortages. The goal for TSA is to get everybody through security in 30 minutes and 10 minutes in a pre-check line. There is some good news for travelers that have pre-check, is that the TSA started moving children aged 13 to 17 into the pre-check line if they're traveling with a parent or guardian who has pre-check. Before, it was just children ages 0 to 12. So it's a little bit easier to travel with children in pre-check and get into that faster pre-check line. Having said that, the TSA is not meeting its 30-minute goal in many airports, mostly hub airports throughout the country. So give a little extra time to fly or fly out of a smaller airport like Madison where you're less likely to wait.
As someone who studies this, Laura, and as you mentioned, somebody who flies a lot, what are your rules of thumb for how early to get to that airport before our flight?
I do have TSA pre-check, and I usually arrive about an hour ahead of time, check my bag, go through security, and I've been doing that for a long time. This year, I'm giving myself a little extra time just in case, because it's not just the congestion. The security checkpoint, there's also congestion checking a bag due to kind of these widespread labor shortages and just more travelers and therefore more queuing. So usually I'm giving myself an extra 15 to 30 minutes when I go to an airport.
When you say an hour ahead of time, is that an hour ahead of the flight's departure time or the start boarding time? They're different.
Usually the departure time. And I'm also flying out of Madison a lot, so it's very reliably short TSA pre-check lines. when I'm flying back, I sometimes give myself a little extra time.
Now, how about the cost comparison? You mentioned the advantages of going into that smaller airport, but it tends to cost a little more, and you have that extra connection. How do you balance those out?
The challenge is that I live in Madison, and we're finding that Madison is actually one of the most expensive airports to fly in and out of in the country. So it's not always the case that flying out of a smaller airport is more expensive, but it is for us in Madison, which also leads to the frustration if flights are delayed for reasons that could be prevented.
Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Rebecca is with us in Milwaukee. Rebecca, hi.
Hi, how are you guys doing?
Good. What do you want to tell us about?
Good. Thanks for taking my call. I'm calling because I'm a frequent flyer, and I do travel back and forth to Canada a lot, typically using Air Canada or United. And what I find with those airlines in particular, in terms of compensation for delays, they love to hide weather or hide mechanical issues in weather. So what will happen is you'll get to the airport and there will be a mechanical issue that you're told about. And then weather might take over, like while you're waiting during the delay. And then they love to call it weather so they won't compensate you. So it's happened to me multiple times. And then all they have on the record when you inquire is that it was weather related, so they don't compensate. So is there any way to deal with that? Do you have any advice?
Interesting question, Rebecca. Is this something you think happens often, Laura? There's maybe a mechanical problem somewhere there. But yeah, it was weather.
Yeah, I've certainly heard of this. And you know, you are at the mercy of how they classify it, because even the proposed rules would not lead to these broad protections for weather. And so, unfortunately, all you could do is call the airline and complain. But once it gets classified in a certain way, it's there's not a lot you can do in real time as a flyer.
All right. Good luck, Rebecca. Thanks for calling in. We're talking about air travel this summer, the kind of delays we might run into along the way. Laura Albert stays with us, professor of industrial and systems engineering at UW-Madison. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have travel plans? Do they involve flying this summer? If you're looking for airfares, are you seeing higher price tags than you might have expected? Do you have advice for making flying less stressful? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our conversation about what to expect if you're flying this summer. Our guest is Laura Albert, professor of industrial and systems engineering at UW-Madison. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have a best or worst air travel experience you've had? Do you want to see the government regulate airlines more to protect consumer rights? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Back to your calls now. Tim is with us in Hollandale. Tim, hi.
Hi. I had a pretty good experience, I guess. I fly over to Europe a lot, and I usually fly Aer Lingus to Ireland. And they overbooked last Christmas, and after, you know, we called them up and said I was bumped from the flight, they immediately compensated me €600. They gave me business class on the next flight the next day and comped my hotel and would have comped any food if I ate any between now, then and when they picked me up. The worst flights I have is actually coming into Madison. And going out of Madison, it's always delayed, it's always a hassle, and it's very expensive. So I'll have to contradict your guest there on that one.
Tim, thanks for the call. So first of all, that overbooking issue, Laura, as I understand, there is federal law requiring more compensation when the airline is overbooked versus that mechanical delay or things like that. But Tim also saying, I think the European system did well by him. Your thoughts on overbooking in the system?
Overbooking is a great strategy for the airlines. It actually helps them keep fares low. And in the U.S., there is some protection, and you know, the airlines cannot force a passenger to take a different flight. But the guest points out how well it can be with protections to be bumped from a flight, and then that follow-up flight, when it's rebooked, can actually be quite pleasant. It doesn't lead to any out-of-pocket expenses for the traveler. So seeing those types of widespread protections is doable and could be make flying a lot more pleasant.
Thanks for that call and sharing that. Heather joins us now in Waukesha. Heather, hi.
Hi. I'm actually part of a group of 10. We're flying out of Chicago tomorrow to go to Italy as a culinary student. So we're just trying to prepare ourselves as far as what we should expect going through TSA and making sure that we're all prepared for what we need to know ahead of time.
Okay, Heather, I got to ask, what are you studying in culinary in Italy? And can we have you on Food Friday when you get back?
So we are actually doing a lot of hands-on cooking over there. So everything will be hands-on. The chefs over in Italy will come to us. We're staying in a villa between Italy and or between Rome and Florence. So it's a small little town. Everybody will come to us. We'll go to local market. I would love to go ahead and come back for Food Friday after I go over there and get to do a lot more hands-on.
Heather, thanks. Or maybe there's room in Heather's luggage and I can stow away in that. Thanks a lot for the call. Heather, advice on a big international trip for a group like that, Laura, flying out of O'Hare. When to get there, what to expect on the way in.
I always leave a lot more time at airports for international flights. One thing that I'll do in recently that I'd recommend is downloading the MyTSA app. This is maybe a reflection that lines have gotten a little bit longer, but the TSA has an app where you can monitor those security lines. So if you're tend to be anxious about that, and many travelers are, that really helps monitor the lines. I also use other apps. My favorite is Flight Aware to just check the status of my flights ahead of time. I can see where the plane is coming from and get a little automated alerts on my phone. Some of that helps manage some of the uncertainty with flying. The other thing that many travelers aren't aware of is it's possible to make an appointment at airport security. Actually, Rome is one of the places where you can make an appointment to go through security. Most of the time you have to be a member of CLEAR, which has a membership cost per year, but it really can make traveling easier and getting through the airport a lot easier if you can reduce a lot of the uncertainty ahead of time.
Heather, thanks a lot for that call. Watch out. I think there was an airline strike or something in Italy. A friend of mine's kid had some trouble getting there not too long ago. So maybe check the papers on that, Heather. And thanks for the call. We're talking about air travel with Laura Albert, professor of industrial and systems engineering at UW-Madison. Laura, I wanted to talk some about, systems to prevent big problems. Let's start with Southwest at the end of last year. As I understand it, they do their routing a little differently than other airlines, what people call a point-to-point system. How are they different? What went wrong? Was it preventable?
Yeah, so what went wrong was with their software system that just couldn't handle the loads of people calling in sick with the Omicron variant. I believe it was just had a lot of manual processes that eventually just were too difficult to manage. And it sounds like it was more of a pain for the employees there than actual passengers until it became a really big problem. You're right in that Southwest has a point-to-point style where they don't have hubs and spokes like all of the other major airlines in the United States. It gives them a competitive advantage because they have a different structure and that they can fly direct flights to places that other airlines don't offer those direct flights. So that's a big part of their business model. And other airlines all use the hub and spoke system where everybody typically flies to a big hub, switches flights, and then takes a second flight to their destination. Both are challenging to manage disruptions. So disruptions do occur, especially large weather disruptions. What a lot of people don't know is regardless of the airline, airlines are actually pretty good at recovering from weather disasters. And they use a lot of mathematical optimization and industrial engineering to get the passengers on the right flights to get to their destination, which is kind of remarkable given that flights do fill up when you have to cancel a lot of flights or many people miss a connection. You can't just put them all on the next flight. There's a limited number of seats. And it's really amazing how just using math and managing all these different flight travel plans are able to manage some of those disruptions after the fact. And that's something that they do proactively that, can make things a little bit better when there is a disruption, could be worse. And that's one thing that they're doing well, but we'd like them to see fewer of these disruptions occur that can be avoided up front. And hopefully we see them make progress in that area in this next year.
Right. We've still seen some trouble. This isn't just a story about Southwest. Are there changes that airlines are making, could make to bring these high recent numbers of delays down? Is it just a matter of letting the labor pool catch up, or are there other things they could be doing?
Yeah, some of it is that. And I'd like to see them, as well as the TSA, be more aggressive in being able to hire employees, offer more generous benefit packages, offer startup or signing bonuses. I believe the TSA is starting to do that. That would really help. And then it's going to take some time to ensure that those employees are trained so that things like baggage handling is very smooth and doesn't lead to flight delays. So it's going to take a little while, but the more aggressive they can be in terms of compensating employees and encouraging more to apply, the better shape we'll be in.
And in terms of demand side, you know, we hear about all these problems with airlines and, you know, sounds like nightmare stories, especially with the Southwest thing. People are still flying, though, right? There's a lot of demand, a lot of people very happy to pay to go on a plane now.
Exactly. Here we are about three years after the pandemic, and travel reduced by 95% during the pandemic. So 3 years ago, travel decreased 95%. So it's actually quite remarkable that the system is working as well as it has, because there's, you know, their labor pool went way down and then came back up. I'm not surprised that travel is bouncing back. People like to travel. And we saw it take a couple years after September 11th to fully bounce back. And there seems to be a human memory. And in this case, we had an ongoing pandemic. But it is nice to see that people are able to fly around the world, travel, take vacations.
All right, we got a minute left. I'm going to ask maybe the nerdiest possible question. You talked about the math that airlines use to keep things flowing. What kinds of math are they plugging in here to make this work?
Yeah, can I say integer programming?
Because that's really exciting. Please do. I don't think we have to bleep that.
Okay. Yeah, so it's a large-scale optimization, and it's basically a lot of discrete math problems and discrete optimization problems. It's a lot of different decisions, figuring out which aircraft should be assigned to which flight, figuring how frequently they should fly between different pairs of city, and then also optimizing the crews. And so sometimes the flight's not delayed or the airplane isn't delayed, but the crew coming from another flight is. And all of those are a lot of decisions. And if there's one disruption, there's a lot of ripple effects, which is why it's so hard and why you need to use large-scale mathematical optimization, which essentially optimizes millions of decision variables at a time. And we have the algorithms and computer power to do that. And it's kind of beautiful.
Laura, we'll leave it there. Thanks for joining us again.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.
That's Laura Albert, professor of industrial and systems engineering at the University of Wisconsin-Madison College of Engineering. Her research focuses on modeling and solving real-world problems, including things like aviation security. She joined us for a look at summer air travel. Still time for you to share your story, for better or worse, of air travel in the recent years. Let us know. Tell us about it over on our email, ideas@WPR.org. That's ideas@WPR.org. Coming up after the news, this week's edition of Food Friday is all about local farm fresh foods. Chef Elena Terry joins us to talk about the best ways to take advantage of our local farmers markets, the local produce we might find at the grocery store, and the ways that local foods can benefit our communities. Hope you'll join that conversation as well. Get a garden report, a farmers market report from your neck of the woods. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network.